Welcome to the Airplane Geeks Podcast. This is episode 67 of the show where we talk about aviation. I'm Max Flight. With me is one of the best co-hosts you could ever want, and another guy. First, welcome back, Dan Webb.
Hello, Max and Rob. It is great to be back. Sorry that I haven't been around the past few weeks.
Good to have you back.
We're going to blame it on school, but it's good to be here this weekend.
Also here is Rob Mark. Hello, Rob.
Well, wait a minute. I want to know where I fit in that little description you had before.
Hey, I leave that to the listener.
I see. Okay. All right. It's going to be one of those kinds of shows. Okay.
So
well,
far.
Listen, I'm always, as always, welcome to everybody that is taking the time to listen to this incredible show.
Our guest today is Paula Williams. She's from Aviation Business Consultants International. ABCI specializes in marketing plans for the aviation industry, including online and social media. Paula's been a marketing consultant, a product manager. She's been a staff writer, an ad designer, a process engineer, and a trainer. But perhaps most exciting, she's recently got her private pilot rating. Welcome, Paula, and congratulations.
Thank you. And we can know which one of those is the most important and the most exciting. So. It's good to be on with you guys. I'm glad that everyone is here, even Dan this week. So this is great.
Yeah.
That's right. So when did you get your private pilot ticket?
It was actually about 2 weeks ago. And I was just telling you guys, it's much, much more difficult to do short field landings with an FAA inspector in the aircraft. And I'm not sure why that is, but it just is.
Oh, I imagine.
It can't have anything to do with nerves or anything.
But, no, of course not. Well, that's
exactly.
Great. That's very exciting.
So where did you go on your long cross country? Because I assume you learned out of Las Vegas somewhere?
I learned out of Salt Lake. And one of my cross countries was to Logan, Utah, which is very pretty. It's in the mountains up here.
I was going
to
say, I thought you meant Boston, Logan.
Yeah. Oh, no. Logan, Utah. So a little town out here. And then the other one was to Wendover, Nevada.
Wow.
Yeah, way out in the middle
that's
of nowhere.
Cool.
Yeah,
pretty
very cool. Salt Lake is Bravo Airspace, so that's really fun.
Oh, man, yeah. Well, congratulations. I mean, that's got to be – isn't that cool when you look at your wallet and now you have this piece of paper that says you're allowed to bring people with?
Exactly. I don't have the card yet. I just have the
printout. It takes about 4 years for that to show up from the FAA.
But oh, great.
Yeah. Yeah.
I'm checking the mail every day, though, so yeah. I'm excited.
That's cool.
It is cool.
Before we get started, I just wanted to mention real quick that the movie Air Racer is now out on DVD. This is the documentary from Chris Webb, who was our guest back on episode 57 of this podcast. And this is the documentary movie about the team that competes in air racing and their journey in that adventure, creating their own, building their own aircraft. And everyone can check that out at www.airracerthemovie.com, or you can go back and listen to episode 57 for more about this exciting movie.
On a movie note, random fact, sorry to just sidetrack it already, but I think in December there's a new movie with George Clooney coming out called Up in the Air, and he's playing a consultant whose like sole purpose in life is to earn as many frequent flyer miles as possible, and I'm very excited.
Ah. You had somebody like that on your show, didn't you?
Yes, we did.
That was really cool.
I thought that was Dan. No, that was somebody else, wasn't it?
That's Ben.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay.
All right. Well, we've got some aviation news, and we've got this week's report from the Airplane Geeks Australia desk. We're pretty sure David Vanderhoof is taking the week off since he's in the middle of a move and kind of without internet, but he should be back next week. So let's start with a few aviation news stories. Everybody ready?
I guess.
The guy is so excited to be here. I mean, why were we concerned when he wasn't here, Max? That's what I want to know.
It's hard to say.
Are we keeping you from your homework?
No. I got it all done yesterday. I've been a good boy, Professor Mark.
Our first story comes from Air Transport World Daily News. BA's Walsh touts all-premium New York to London flight as bold step. British Airways CEO Willie Walsh described the carrier's new all-business class A318 New York JFK to London City service as a, quote, vote of confidence in the future. He's reported as saying, it's a bold step. We are putting down a marker that we are confident about the future. So this is kind of an interesting move. I mean, the A318 is kind of a unique aircraft from a size perspective, right? It's sort of a downsized A320 class airplane. And BA is going for a all business class version of this. Do you think there's a market for this out there?
I think it's going to work. I mean, they only have to fill, the plane can only fit 32 people. So it's, I mean, you really don't have to bring over a whole bunch of passengers. Granted, premium traffic has been very, very weak lately, but I think this really can work. I mean, if you work in the financial district of London, this is so way more convenient than going all the way to Heathrow. And yes, it does. I know Virgin Atlantic has been mocking British Airways because the A318 is a bit slower on the route, and especially because it has to stop in Shannon on the way to New York. But I think it's going to work out, especially because, yes, they need fuel in Shannon, but also you can pre-clear customs in Shannon.
Right, right.
So you arrive in JFK as if it's any other domestic flight, which is really cool. And then plus with London City, it's very close to a lot of big businesses. It's a small airport. You can check in very, very close to departure time. And just the fact that you have to avoid customs at Heathrow or Kennedy, I think this one will work.
And the name of this is what? Is this not the service that British Airways was talking about putting together at the end of last year that was going to sort of be their non-union organization? Or am I
that,
thinking
that,
of something
that was
else?
Open Skies?
Oh, I see. And this is not Open Skies.
Yeah, this is regular straight up British Airways mainline. And I mean, just symbolically, what's very interesting, they resurrected the old Concorde flight numbers for this one.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
So 001 and all that sort of thing.
Yeah, so I don't know exactly what the flight numbers are now, because I think there's less. Right now, they only have one A318 doing it. But I think in a few days, the second aircraft will come online. So I think this one will work out. Open Skies, supposedly they've been saying that they've been doing great in Paris, so that's all they're doing right now is flights to Paris to New York. Supposedly they're trying to sell the thing off, but Open Skies isn't doing as well.
And what is the airplane Open Skies is using? I thought they were using a 319 or something, aren't they?
They're using a 75.
A 75, oh, okay.
Yes,
And it's not doing well because of the fact that they just can't load up the airplane? Too big.
Well, I think one reason is, I mean, they're all gone established routes, so Kennedy to Paris and Amsterdam, very established. The other reason, which I've heard, and I'm not an expert on the European market, is it's kind of a branding issue. You can tell, like, they really don't advertise that it's a British Airways service, because there is kind of this kind of weird, if you're flying France to U.S., usually you would want to fly Air France. Supposedly, I've heard that, like, if you're native to a European country, you wouldn't fly another carrier. I have no idea if that's true or not. That's one argument I've heard. But it's just the weakness of premium traffic. Then again, with this service, with so few seats in the market, and the fact that it has all these extra areas of convenience, I think it can work.
Cool. I'm sorry. That's right. I'm not supposed to say that.
Well, from a customer's perspective, I mean, you can see how it would be nice to have that convenience of just being able to step off like you live in New York, you know, just like a commuter service.
I mean, it is a great concept. I mean, I guess the question, of course, is I'd be curious to know what the ticket price is.
It is more expensive. I think I saw £3,000 somewhere. So it is a bit more expensive than a British Airways Club World seat.
Is that one way or round trip?
I think round trip. I think. Oh. And then again, the whole convenience factor.
Yeah, maybe the premium market can support that.
I mean, they're going to have extra food service for you, I believe, at London City. I just think the fact that you get to clear customs is really nice.
Yeah, I think a lot of people find that attractive.
Yeah, so I think this one will work out. but we will see.
Okay, next up we have this from china.org.cn. AVIC, General Aviation, scouts for stakes in foreign firms. We've been talking a little bit about China and what's going on in aviation there lately, and in this report, we see that AVIC General Aviation Company is seeking equity participation in a foreign general aviation aircraft manufacturer to strengthen its development capabilities and to explore the overseas market. The quote from Tan Wei Dong, he's the president of AVIC General Aviation Company, and he says, "We are now talking to several foreign companies. We might completely acquire a company or take a controlling stake. We hope to reach an agreement by the end of this year." Now, this is kind of interesting. I mean, in the past, we've talked about airframers maybe sourcing components from China. And this is a different kind of an animal, though. This is China, you know, reaching out into existing companies and taking ownership in them. That's quite a different kind of a move.
Especially for the companies in the States here that are fragile, let's say. I mean, Hawker Beechcraft being one of them. And I think it's an interesting, the most interesting aspect, I think, though, of this whole thing is that we still will not allow a foreign entity to own more than, you know, 49% of the, or 25% of the controlling stock of an airline. But we would allow them to come in most likely and purchase or, you know, develop this premium equity stake in an aircraft manufacturer, and nobody would seem to have any trouble with it. Why is that, Dan? What do you think that stems from?
This stems from a little known program called the Civil Reserve Air Fleet, I believe. I haven't read up on this completely, but basically, God forbid we're in a major world conflict with a Civil Reserve Air Fleet, commercial aircraft can be used for military operations. And I guess the fear is that if a foreign entity owns the majority of an airline, they won't do that. And I mean, as a little bit of a kickback, there is another act that government employees have to basically fly American carriers internationally whenever possible. It's a little weird thing. Personally, I'd love to see more than 50% ownership with a foreign entity, but I'd love to see 49%. But that is, I believe, where it stems from.
You know, what I find myself wondering when I look at this news is what AVIC's, you know, kind of long-term goal is in doing this. I mean, you could consider that they might be looking to jumpstart a domestic Chinese general aviation industry because, as we've talked in the past, it really doesn't exist today to any great extent. You know, or they may be looking not so much internal but towards, you know, business activity, the industry in other developed countries that do have a stronger GA industry, and just look for a piece of that pie.
Of course, the fact that the Chinese own so much of the American debt anyway, for all I know, this may already be a done deal.
I think the Chinese own...
We just don't even know it yet. I mean,
last time I checked, which was like in April or March, I think they have $700 billion in American debt.
I don't know, Paula, if you've, you know, encountered in your business or in your dealings, you know, issues surrounding sort of the different cultures and how they might use, you know, online marketing or social media or things like that. And I'm thinking of, you know, many times when you look at the website of, you know, a Chinese company, for example, even pretty large, well-known ones, they don't look exactly like, you know, what us in the Western world kind of come to expect.
Exactly.
How can they address that?
I think it is a disadvantage. And, you know, the fact that it's not a solid career to be involved in the internet in China, you know, unless you're on the government's payroll and, you know, in the process of, you know, the part of the group of people that turns it off every time they have an anniversary of an event or something that causes the government issues, you know, like in June when they turned off Twitter, Flickr, YouTube, WordPress,
right, yeah.
Blogger, Bing, Hotmail, you know, all of those social media channels. When that happens intermittently and without, you know, any real control on the part of a company, they're not going to invest a lot of money in using that channel, you know, even to broadcast outside of their country. So, you know, because they can't see it themselves.
Yes.
So, you know, that makes it really hard to make an investment in something if you don't know for sure that it's going to be consistently available. And I think that will change over time, as it will everywhere in the world, as people become used to the fact that it's a force of nature like gravity. You know, there are more people trying to get in than there are trying to keep you from getting out. So, that's it's one of those things that's going to be interesting to watch in the next probably 5 or 10 years, because if they really want to be involved in the world markets, they really have to think about that as part of their strategy. And if they're going to allow it as part of their strategy, they have to accept the bathwater along with the baby.
Right. Next up from Aviation Week, Eclipse Aerospace gets EA 500 certificate. Aviation Week reports that the FAA's Fort Worth Aircraft Certification Office has transferred the Eclipse 500 type certificate to the new Eclipse Aerospace LLC. That's the firm that bought the assets and the IP of the old Eclipse Aviation. The article says that, however, production won't begin for at least 1 or 2 years because of the need to support the existing fleet while it's building its financial reserves. Also says that in the interim, Eclipse Aerospace expects to start offering Avio NG 1.5 and flight into known icing upgrades in the next few weeks for the 154 aircraft equipped with Avio NG. So, Rob, that's kind of the first order of business, isn't it? The Eclipse jets that had been previously delivered aren't fully compliant, and they need to get these things up to spec, right?
I'm still absolutely amazed that this is even happening. I don't think anybody in the industry believed that anything would actually come to be from this. And of course, I'm still a tad skeptical that it will. But yes, to answer your question, yes, that without the avionics being issues being settled and the flight into known icing being settled, most of these Eclipses are nice VFR jets. Is really what they are. I mean, there's an right. operator here in Chicago that has some, and we're coming into the winter weather now, and without the ability to file and take off into the ice, it's kind of a nice toy, but it's not much more than that.
I noticed that the new company has now officially got title to the former Dayjet Eclipse jets, that amounting to about 28 of them. So,
but you know what I think is probably even more the issue here too is that you'll notice in that story it says they don't have a manager for the Albuquerque facility yet,
right.
And what I would be asking, which I'm sure other people are as well, is that if Eclipse in its original iteration couldn't make it, what are you doing differently to convince people that you are going to be successful in this venture when they couldn't with all the money they had behind them?
Yeah, that's the real question. And, you know, maybe it's just a matter of scaling back the scope and building a business plan that relies on, you know, much slower growth than the original Eclipse thought. But again, you've got to have a viable business plan out of that. And I agree that it's kind of surprising that they seem to be moving in a positive and productive direction.
Well, we'll see. I guess that's about all we can do right now is kind of keep our eye on them.
I think we should get a review copy.
Oh, there you go.
Yeah, if it's a nice toy, I would like one to play with.
Yeah.
Yeah. You have to have a multi-engine rating, Paula. That's next.
Next, yeah.
Okay.
Well, if you're interested in Eclipse, the original source for that was always the Eclipse Aviation Critic NG, which actually was sort of the second generation of the Eclipse blog, run by Shane Price, who we had on this podcast some time ago. But I noticed that he's gone on to other things, and the Eclipse Aviation Critic NG blog has been replaced by something called the Aviation Critic and Enthusiast that's being run by Stan Blankenship. And you can find that at aviationcriticenthusiast, all jammed together, .blogspot.com. And I think it's intended to be just a little bit more than just strictly a Eclipse-focused blog. I think the intent is that it, you know, looks at general aviation in a little bit of a broader sense. But there's certainly a lot of information there about the Eclipse. So invite everyone to check that out. Okay, next story comes from the New York Times. Europe has antitrust concerns in airline alliance. The European Union's antitrust regulator has said that it has raised objections to a joint venture proposed by British Airways, American Airlines, and the Spanish flag carrier Iberia because of concerns it would curtail competition. Of course, BA and American and Iberia are all members of the One World Alliance, but this proposed arrangement sort of puts them into more of a deeper mode of sharing revenue, joint marketing, and scheduling decisions on a variety of different flights. And the EU is not so sure that this is something that they want to see.
They're a bunch of whiners. I'm going to put it that way.
I've recently heard the EU referred to as the nanny state because, you know, in aviation, in, you know, computer operating systems, in web browsers, there's been a lot of activity lately where the sort of legacy powerhouses have been deemed to be anti-competitive in the eyes of the EU.
Well, I mean, American and British Airways, they've been trying to finally make their relationship official, Facebook official, actually. Okay, I'm sorry. Apparently, there's a generational gap there.
Yeah, Rob and I are going, huh? Paula probably knows.
I know what that is. I think it's a good term.
I've heard of Facebook. I know what that is. Don't try to pull a wool over my eyes.
Well, you know what a relationship is not official unless if it's on Facebook. So
or Twitter, right.
Or Twitter.
Yeah. Well, Twitter's not as official as Facebook. Facebook's really official. Twitter's just kind of thinking about it. So.
Right. The relationship status needs to change.
Right.
So anyway, they've been trying to hook up for years and years and years, and it just has never worked out. Now, I would have agreed with the EU here if Heathrow was still very closed off. However, when the Open Skies Treaty was signed between the EU and the US, it was opened up, and that's why you saw a bunch of American carriers move over from Gatwick to Heathrow. I believe beforehand it was only American United who could get into Heathrow. But at this point, I don't see why they shouldn't have it because Star Alliance and SkyTeam have it. To tell you the truth, I haven't looked at the numbers, but I'm pretty sure that Air France has bigger market share in Paris, and Lufthansa has a bigger market share in Frankfurt than British Airways does at Heathrow. I think it puts them at a big competitive disadvantage to the other two alliances. It would allow, I don't know, it was just like you can't earn frequent flyer miles on a British Airways flight if you're an American, I think. Because a couple episodes ago, we talked about this with my interview with Simon Talling Smith. It would allow them to retime their flights so they wouldn't compete with each other. I think it would work out really well, simply because the other alliances have it. Just give it to British Airways. Granted, Virgin Atlantic is whining about this, as is expected. But they should just get it. If you're going to give it to SkyTeam and Star Alliance, give it to Oneworld. And that's basically all I have to say about that.
So you're saying fair is fair?
Yes.
It's going to be really interesting to see where that goes, though, because as you said, this American-British Airways thing has been going on for, at least 10 years, I would think. And they've gotten close, twice, I think? And it was shut down?
I don't remember exactly, and I mean, I'm surprised the DOT, and I want to see what the DOT thinks about this, because, I mean, SkyTeam was smart to get their stuff together before the Bush administration left, because I feel there was a justified fear that maybe the current administration be a little less friendly to things like this, but they let Continental join SkyTeam no problem, and join Atlantic Plus, so they should just get it. Yes, it would give them dominant market share in a lot of routes, but Lufthansa has dominant market share to Frankfurt, and Air France has dominant market share to Paris, and KLM is dominant in Amsterdam. So just give it to BA and move on.
What do you think would happen if this all comes together with the BA American thing, and then the next phase of the open skies issue between the British and the Americans doesn't come together? I mean, what would that be like?
Well, I mean, who knows exactly where Open Skies will go? I mean, there has been kind of dissatisfaction that an American carrier can fly to anywhere in the EU right now, and the EU really doesn't really have the same agreement over here. Like, we will probably never see a domestic flight here in the U.S. operated by a European airline. They're like that. But I was on a call, a conference call, for IATA a couple weeks ago, and they don't think that's really ever going to happen either, just because of these alliances. So, I mean, who knows where Open Skies is going to go, but I think this is a good move.
Okay.
All right, next up, this is from TradingMarkets.com. MHI gets first overseas order for passenger jet from U.S. airline. This is, of course, about the Mitsubishi regional jet, and Mitsubishi has won an order from Transstate Holdings, which really is the corporate parent. Is that the word I want to use?
Well, it's good that you mentioned holdings, because they have Transstate's Airlines and GoJet, and it has not been determined what carrier would have these aircraft.
Okay, this is for 50 firm and 50...
50 options?
Gosh, I couldn't think of the word.
Yeah, it gets worse when you get older.
It does.
I mean, but come on, seriously, does anybody believe that this is gonna happen? I mean, not the order, but I guess...
You mean the whole jet?
I would find myself being less cynical of this order. And again, it has nothing to do with the quality of the Japanese airplane. I'm just simply talking about the company that's ordering. I mean, if Transstates had ordered, oh, I don't know, let's say 10 or 15 with a few options, I mean, it might sound a little believable. But 100 airplanes in a day when even the majors can't get financing, I'm a little skeptical of that. Well, Dan, maybe you could make me feel better about it.
Well, I mean, this is Mitsubishi's really first foray into the regional market. So I am so absolutely positive that Transstate's got an awesome deal. I'm not sure exactly how the financing works. I mean, it's always hard to find the details of this, but I'm sure Mitsubishi wants orders for this thing. So I kind of doubt that maybe Transstate's even put money down on this thing yet. And who knows exactly where this is going to go. I mean, deliveries won't be for about 5 years. This thing hasn't even been assembled yet. But,
maybe not five. Mitsubishi says they're looking to launch it in 2012.
Because I was hearing deliveries in 2014. So that's what I was going by.
The launch customer, of course, is All Nippon Airways. They have 25 on order. And other than ANA, it's Transstate Holdings now. Those are the two customers they've got
right,
so far.
So they want orders for this thing. So breaking into the U.S. regional market is cool for them. Around that time, that's when 2014 is around when some contracts apparently with Transstate are going to expire right now. They have a bunch of ERJs going for United, a few ERJs for U.S. Airways. Then GoJet has about, I think, 22 CRJ-700s flying for United. So we don't know if this is going to replace any of those. Granted, mm-hmm. The 50-seat RJ is not as attractive as it was a few years ago. And plus, Transstate hasn't specified what version they're using. There's a 70, a 90, which I think is 76, 92 seats, and then they're thinking about stretching it again to seat 100.
Right.
No specification of what they're ordering, but then if you start going into that 90, 100 seat range, now you've opened up the Pandora's box of scope clauses, which is huge right now. Well, it's always huge. I mean, the Embraer 140 exists because of a scope clause. So that opens up because what I've heard is scope clauses are weird. They're done in different ways that this plane is actually in some clauses, it's too heavy, some too many seats. So who knows who's going to allow that to be operated, because the industry could look very different in a few years. So we'll have to see how it works out. But this is big.
Anyway, I just would have felt a little more comfortable in this day and age if I had heard just a tad about how they were going to pay for these things. Otherwise, it sounds a bit like too much PR to me.
Mitsubishi just wants an order for this thing. And if they can break into the regional market here, this is big for them, because this has been a market really enjoyed by Embraer and Bombardier, with Embraer's 170, 175, 190, 195. And Bombardier is the CRJ-700, the 900, the new 1000. The C-Series 100 will kind of compete with this thing. It'll be a bit bigger. But then you do have some other players coming in this market around the same time. You have the ARJ from China, which is coming. And then you have, I don't know how to pronounce their name. I don't want to sound like an idiot, but the Sukhoi Superjet.
Yeah, that's
coming
it.
Out. Okay, yay. I said something right. So this market will heat up. And it'll be interesting to see if Bombardier and Embraer will respond, if they come out with something new, if they will revamp their current offerings. I mean, there have been rumblings that Embraer is working on a new aircraft, and that they've met with Delta about this, but who knows what will happen.
All right. Well, speaking of, you know, who knows what the future will bring, we have this from Boeing. A tale goes on as another ends. This is actually an article from Boeing Frontiers publication, which is sort of an in-house employee publication that's widely available. And in fact, you can really anybody can subscribe to it by email. And it typically has some kind of interesting stories. This is about Boeing Research and Technology continuing to work along with NASA on the X-48C blended wing body demonstrator aircraft. You may recall that before Boeing started, at least publicly, talking about the Dreamliner, that there was some discussion and, in fact, some photographs in the press about a blended wing body airliner that they were working on. So it turns out that really Boeing has continued to develop that. They actually have some scaled demonstrator models that fly, and they're continuing to do wind tunnel testing on these models. This C version of the aircraft has a 21 foot wingspan, weighs about 500 pounds, and they're looking to build a flying model of that. Well, you know, you talk about a sort of a game changer. This blended wing body kind of design really tosses out the everybody sitting in a tube approach to flying and comes up with something completely different.
No, it's really interesting. When I was at a conference in June, when Gary Kelly was speaking, he specifically mentioned about this type of aircraft being the future. And it'll be interesting how it goes. One thing about blended wing aircraft is, from what I looked at and what I've heard, is you have an airport infrastructure issue, because airports and terminals have always been designed for the everyone sitting in a tube aircraft.
That's a good point.
So, I mean, just think of what airports have done to equip for the A380. Who knows what will happen with these guys, depending on how wide they are. But it could affect some future airport and terminal designs, I think.
It also drastically cuts back on the percentage of seats that have windows.
This is true. Though it would be cool, I guess, technically. Could you have a window in the front of the wing, sort of?
Maybe. It's kind of like stadium seating in a way. Or auditorium seating, maybe. That opens the possibility to, a really completely different kind of flight experience if they want to design one around that.
So we got to put like a boxing ring in this thing, you're saying, for entertainment.
I was thinking of like roller derby.
All right. That works.
I think it's a cool idea, though. I really do. And the only thing that's a little, I shouldn't say disappointing. Maybe that's not the word I'm struggling for. But I remember back when Boeing was trying to build an SST years ago, and then they just said, on second thought, no, because we can't deal with the supersonic issue over the States, and never mind. And then look at the Concorde. I mean, what a great technology. I mean, for its day, it was an impressive machine. And then we just stopped. And so I'm really glad to see this kind of technology being talked about, because I think I don't see how this industry is ever going to become more than it is right now without this kind of direction.
Well, the thing about the Boeing SST and the Concorde is that they are just so expensive.
You think this won't be expensive?
Well, one of the reasons people have looked into this technology is that supposedly this can offer significant fuel savings. So if you want to go with that argument, yes.
Significant fuel savings aren't going to be enough. I mean, the technology to develop the airframe is going to be pretty impressive. I mean,
a whole other issue, I think, that was going on. Now, granted, I was not alive then, but you were, Rob. Huh?
What are you going to say, Dan? In the 1800s? Come on.
No. But back in that era, I think when you had the Tupolev, I think it was the 144 and the Concorde and Boeing, you almost had like a kind of a nationalistic thing going at the same time. At least that's what I think, at least with the Russian SST. But this whole idea that we need to go supersonic to stay ahead. But if this thing can be very economical, we'll see. Now, it will be expensive, yes, but if there are significant cost savings here, why not?
Another thing is that this kind of flying wing configuration really allows placement of things like open rotor engines. And, you know, we may or may not end up in that direction, but if we do go in that direction, this is kind of the ideal shape for that. Okay, Dan has a interview that we'd like to play. Dan, you want to...
I thought you were going to say Dan had to leave.
No, Dan still...
Ouch. I was just trying to be courteous of the young man's time.
Sure.
That was.
So, Dan, what have we got here?
So, finally, I had my last interview from the National Business Travel Association Conference in San Diego, and this is with Christy Van Alken. She is a Senior Vice President and the Chief Marketing and Communications Officer with Akron Canton Airport in Ohio, and they do some wicked cool stuff with social media. So I just talked to her about that and a few other things, so I thought you guys might find this one interesting.
So, Christy, I'm here at MBTA, and as I'm walking the show floor, I'm not seeing a lot of airports here, and CAC is one of the few. Why did you decide to come to the show this year?
Well, this is a great show for us because it helps us position ourselves as another way to get into the Cleveland area. So Cleveland is a full region of 4.2 million people. There's two great airports, really, that you can access our market, and so we need to inform travel managers about that. And often, you know, the folks that might be in different communities from throughout the U.S., they may not know how close we are to Cleveland. So it's really our obligation, our duty to come here to entertain them a little bit, to have a lot of fun, and to educate them about the advantages of flying into Akron Canton and when their business travelers are coming into our region.
So how many years have you been at MBTA?
This, I think, is our eighth year at MBTA, and I'm a big believer in the association. I know a lot of the folks that are on staff here. Plus, I actually served on the aviation committee for MBTA for a couple of years. So it's a really great partnership. I love what they do. I like being an allied member. It's important to continue to learn and to grow, and the only way you can do that is by coming together at formats like this where everybody's assembled at one time and you learn what the best practices are in the industry right now.
Do you have any estimate as to how many people you've brought over to CAC from through activities like this?
You know, that's a really good question. I mean, metrics and measurements always the big dog that can come up and bite you. What we know is that we're establishing much stronger relationships with these travel managers than we ever had before, and that's got to be paying off. So often what we find is that people will come back to our booth and they'll say, hey, I remember you here from last year, and we sent people through there as a result of your presence last year. So we know that we're developing those relationships, that the message is getting out there, but of course it's not the only thing we do to try to attract new passengers to our airport. So in addition to like this, we also do some search engine optimization, some other ways where people can get the message that we are indeed a true alternative, a very viable alternative to getting into the Cleveland market.
Now, I like how you mentioned some of the other activities you're doing because CAC is very big into the social media scene. I think on Twitter you have more followers than some major airports out there.
Correct.
And then you have a very active Facebook page as well. So how do you think social media fits into a marketing strategy for an airport?
Okay, well, the most important thing is that you have to know who you're talking to, why you're talking to them in the first place, and then you can start getting into the strategy against, the market that you're trying to attract and the customers. And for us, I mean, we're a public sector organization, all right? So I don't think of customers as, kind of commodities. To me, they are people. They are people that live in my community, that we want to share with them all of the benefits of having a local airport. We want to share with them the relaxed experience we have, and we need their support. So for us, it's really about developing relationships with really great people. But in order to do that, you do have to know who you're talking to, what messages are relevant to this particular demographic. And so for us, the social media piece is all about talking to young, tech-savvy, college-graduated, high likelihood travelers. So that's why we do it. We have a lot of fun with it, which is a unique element of what we're doing. This is just not an RSS feed of press releases. We're not trying to regurgitate news in a different way. What we're trying to do is develop relationships with people we really care about.
So let's just talk about Twitter real quick. What would you generally tweet? Would you talk about what your carrier's doing? Could you talk about delays or weather? What do you usually tweet about?
Yeah, we talk about all of that. So we want to promote our partners. So if there's a fair sale in the market, for instance, we can let a lot more people know about it by retweeting it. If there is something happening at the airport that people would like to know about, a special event, like for instance, we've got a christening event coming up. We've got two amazing new fire trucks, and we only get these fire trucks once every 16 years, so we're going to celebrate that. We're going to have a christening ceremony, so we'll actually tweet live from the event itself. So it's just kind of neat opportunities like that for us to connect with people, for them to see what we do a little bit even behind the scenes, and then also to use it as an informational tool. So for instance, if there's a delay, or let's say that there's bad weather in the area, particularly in the winter, then we will use it for informational purposes like that as well. It's a great tool for that. Another important thing that we do with Twitter is that we monitor what's going on, what people are saying, not only about our airport, but other airports in the region. We want to know. We want to know so that we can respond. So sometimes somebody will even put up like a twit pic on their account, and they'll say something that could be potentially a bad experience for them, something that we don't want them to have. So they might say, in a long line at Akron Canton Airport. So we immediately go out there and respond to them and say, okay, now, is the line moving? Did you get to the airport 6 minutes before your flight? Are there people there? Do you think you're going to make it to your gate on time? Yeah. You know, is there anybody we can help you? So that they know that we care and that we want to respond to them, and that we, again, it's just that little extra step that we can do to engage our customers.
Yeah, well, I think it's cool because people, I was talking to, I think, Troy Bello over at Richmond.
Yeah, he's a master, by the way. He's very good.
And he was saying that passengers will tweet about everything.
They will.
And so
everything.
Whether it's I'm in line at security, the check-in line is annoying, the bathroom is dirty.
Yeah, they share.
So I think that's really cool that you're monitoring other airports. What are you looking for?
Well, we're looking for how they're communicating with their passengers. We're looking for, you know, because we like to learn from other people. So if they've done something that we admire, then we might adopt that particular practice too in what we're doing. We like to promote other airports. So often if we find that, you know, like Richmond, on Follow Fridays, we will retweet them so that we can help push followers to their airport as well. So there's a lot of different ways. I mean, certainly for competitive reasons, we want to know what people are saying about their experiences at Hopkins or at Pittsburgh or other airports. It's just smart business, frankly, to listen to what people are saying about you and to respond to it whenever you can.
Absolutely. So what do you think your carriers think about your social media activities?
They love it. And so far we've used social media with 4 out of our 5 carriers. So, for instance, when U.S. Airways started new nonstop service to Washington National Airport, we tweeted about it, we Facebooked about it, we did contests, we did all of these fun things on our social media channels, and they loved it. They thought it was a blast. We tweeted live from the inaugural flight, we put up pictures, so it was just really neat. We had a very affirming experience there. AirTran and Akron Canton Airport have done a lot of partnerships, the most recent one being this $25 voucher. So here's the deal. At this time of year, we're going into September, huge shoulder season in the industry, so, you know, we go to our partners and we say, what can we do to stimulate a little demand here on a shoulder season? And so we came up with this voucher idea. Kansas City had done one. We learned from their experience. We said, let's do this in Akron Canton as well. And fortunately, they said, okay, well, we'll partner with you on this. And as a result of that, we've actually tripled the size of our Facebook group. And now we've got the largest fan group of any airport in the U.S., following Little CAK, and it's so fun.
Which is incredible, considering how many passengers you have a year.
1.5 million a year.
Yeah, so compared to some of the huge airports out there, that's really incredible that you've done so much. I think that's all I want. Anything else you wanted to talk about?
No, I think I'm just delighted that that you've taken an interest in us, and I wish you well in your career as you move forward, and let me know when you'll look for an internship.
Well, Christy, thank you very much for joining me.
Okay, Dan.
All right, very good. That was very interesting. Paula, was there a particular aspect of that that resonated with you?
Oh, yeah. And, you know, you did an interview last week, I think, or a couple of weeks ago with Paula Berg of Southwest, and it's
right,
the same
right.
Idea. And I love people who get it, you know, and who really understand that social media is not magic. Good people are good people, and social media lets them show that. And lets them, you know, connect with people. And, you know, we can get into that a little bit more later. But I love the fact that, you know, she sees it as communities rather than competition. Mm-hmm. And that she sees it as people rather than numbers, relationships rather than numbers. Nobody cares how many followers you have on Twitter or how many people you have on Facebook. What they care about is those relationships and whether people are actually interacting with you, whether you're right. solving their problems, whether they're buying from you. You know, that's really what it boils down to. And she gets that. That's really, really cool to hear.
Yeah, in fact, one thing that I took away, and of course, I'm tweeting about this even as we speak, Dan, because I thought that was such a great quote that she had there about the fact that it's just smart business to listen to what people are saying about your airport. I mean, what a great idea. And I also agree very much with what Paula said, and I think it's a slow push. I mean, there are an awful lot of people in this industry that are very slow to change, but I think that while many of the organizations and some of the bigger airports are saying, you know, it's a waste of time, and all these little places, you know, well, relatively small airports like Akron, Canton are going to be just doing their thing, and then one of these days people are going to look at them and say, wow, how did this all happen? Where have we been? And so I think they're on the right track, even if some people don't appreciate what they're doing.
Well, it can't be a big waste of time. I mean, if you're in social media for the wrong reasons, then, you know, I mean, it's just another tool. And, you know, there are people who are using it the wrong way, and it is a waste of time. So, you know, but she's got it, and it's working for her. And it's all about the objective and using the right tool for the right objective. And she's got that. So that's neat to see.
Again, we're joined this episode by Paula Williams from Aviation Business Consultants International. Paula, again, thanks for joining us on the podcast.
Thank you for having me.
Maybe you can tell us a little bit about what was your thinking when you formed Aviation Business Consultants International?
Well, we actually call it ABCI usually more often because it's
easier
to say.
Easier, yes.
Exactly. Well, I've been in marketing for probably 15 years and in internet marketing for most of that. And it's all been in finance and telecom and education and other industries. And my husband is an old aviator, old military pilot. He's not old, but he's been doing it for a lot longer than I have, we'll put it that way. So I've really only gotten interested in aviation in the last year or two, and I've only gotten interested in marketing for aviation in the last year. So I'm the new kid on the block as far as that goes, but I do know an awful lot about marketing, and I've worked mostly for very conservative companies like Wells Fargo and Teleperformance and EduStructures and Pearson Education, you know, things, companies that like their reputations
yes.
and are reluctant to start something new. So I think that's a really good fit for aviation. As you mentioned, it's a slow push. And when I say I'm in marketing, people tend to run away screaming because a lot of people have had bad experiences with marketing in general or with online marketing in particular, or they think that it's very, very technical.
Mm-hmm.
And it's the same as any other kind of marketing. It follows the same principles. It's just a matter of using different tools in some cases. So I really enjoy working in aviation.
Is the big challenge then convincing a company that they need to look at these things rather than, you know, they come to you saying, okay, we want to do these things now, show us how?
Well, I'll tell you, the first conversation I have with almost every client or potential client is, I have already spent $250,000 on marketing and it didn't get me what I wanted. How are you going to be any different? So, you know, that's hurdle number one. And, you know, usually I ask them, okay, so what was your objective for this marketing campaign that you did and spent all this money on?
And
they say they don't know. Yeah. Exactly. And that's exactly the issue, is that most marketing that goes on, it seems like in the world, is not really that well planned or not really that well measured. And regardless of the tools you're using, you gotta do the front end work. And that includes them and me. You know, they have to commit to being part of that collaboration and deciding, what do you really want? What do you really need? And what are you willing to commit in order to get what you want to need? there's a book I've been reading that's actually really good. It's called Adland, Searching for the Meaning of Life on a Branded Planet by James Othmer. Actually, it's really, really good. But, you know, he's talking about how marketing is changing and how people just zip past commercials on TV now using their DVRs. They read magazines and newspapers online rather than having to buy them. And, you know, his conclusion is that Madison Avenue is dead and gone. You know, I don't know whether or not I agree with that, but it is an interesting book for that reason. And it's, I think, a thing that's, it's a really good place to be in aviation right now because the economy is forcing people to change. You know, if what you've been doing isn't working, then it's time to try something else. Like this London flight you were talking about earlier, or the blended wing design, you know, my favorite thing right now is the G1000 navigation system, you know, in my Skyhawk. Mm-hmm. And it's a great tool, you know, but my instructor keeps turning it off and saying, you know, quit playing with the toys and fly the airplane. And, you know, that's what I want to say to a lot of people that I do marketing campaigns for is quit playing with the toys and fly the airplane. You know, let's look at what your objective is for marketing, and then we'll figure out which tools to use and how to go about using them in a way that makes sense for your customers and doesn't just mean that you're making noise and doesn't just mean that you're spending a lot of time on social media or, you know, on the other hand, avoiding social media because it won't avoid you. There's people talking about you whether you're listening or not. Exactly. So.
Are there some examples that you can give us, some of your clients or some of the companies that you've worked with?
Yeah, I think, you know, one of the really cool ones, and this one is almost so new that it's hard to tell you, you know, metrics on it, but Pilot Geek is one that's really cool. It's a software program that sends alerts to your cell phone, you know, so it's the perfect demographic for Facebook. You were mentioning a couple of weeks ago that Twitter is kind of for the more sophisticated corporate type people who want, you know, really short pieces of news that are usually connected to a link. And they're usually, you know, real substantial pieces of information for people who want the bare bones of information really quickly. And Facebook is for people that want to interact more richly and, you know, want to be part of a community and things like that. So it's a great fit for Pilot Geek because it's for student pilots. It was developed for student pilots and CFIs and recreational pilots and that kind of community. And these are people who love to go places, love to go to restaurants, you know, the $100 hamburger experience, you know, and love to tweet and write and blog and take video of their experiences. And we just started a feature on their website about destinations, you know, where have you been and what was it like and what was the airport like, what was the FBO like, what was the food like, most importantly, and, you know, give it a rating and, you know, upload your pictures and your video and tell us about it. And that's been really, I think it's too soon to know for sure what the numbers are going to be like on that, but I think it hits the right demographics in the right way and engages those relationships rather than just numbers. So that's
Paula, let me ask you something about Pilot Geek. I mean, is that sort of a is that a standalone company piece of software, or is that something that would possibly be integrated into someone's social media presence?
Well, it is actually one guy. He's an engineer, and he developed it. He's also a pilot. And, you know, so it's not really integrated into anything at this point, you know, but it is a great little standalone, and it's a great backup for your G1000 or, you know, whatever you have in your airplane, and also for getting your weather in your weather briefing before you go.
And he's a geek, right?
He's a geek. Yeah, absolutely. You know, which is wonderful.
I think that alone is quite an endorsement. And I think really, you know, the point I think of this whole issue that Paul is mentioning, at least from my perspective too, is how difficult, as I mentioned earlier, it has been in this industry to convince people, some of the big organizations, the, as you mentioned before about, you know, whether Wall Street's dead or not, while they are trying to figure it out, there are companies like this that are just out there building things and getting them out there in the world. And look at the iPhone. I mean, I don't know how many apps are there, 50, 60,000 different apps now on the iPhone.
Exactly. Every fourth grader in the world can write one.
that's right. And again, I think that one of these days, these large organizations are going to say, What hit us? What happened? Why didn't you tell us about this? And unfortunately, we can always say we tried, didn't we?
Well, and I think the other side of that is that, you know, the message that people are getting is you have to get on Twitter, you have to get on Twitter, you have to get on Twitter, which is kind of crazy. It's like saying you have to breathe the air, you have to breathe the air, or you have to use a G1000. That's not necessarily true, but it is a really cool tool. And, you know, there may be something that you're missing out on if you don't at least look into it. So, you know, I think you really need to, number one, before you get on Twitter, you have to figure out what your objectives are. And if they would be served by that tool, then get that tool. And get if you don't have time to use it yourself, get somebody to show you or get somebody to do it for you.
Yeah, good point.
Yeah, and that's another thing is a lot of businesses are cutting down on people like nobody's business, which is really pretty tragic. And the people that are left are working crazy hours. And, you know, so anything that they can do to make their lives easier rather than just adding another duty, you know, is really important. So, you know, if you can readjust some of your marketing budget and readjust some of your marketing time to something that's more effective, then you need to do that. But you don't need to just add on, you know, get on Twitter because everybody says you should if you're not real clear on what that is and how it would work for you.
That's right.
It's not magic.
So, let's try an example. Rob, Dan, and myself, we're all on Twitter. But there's also an Airplane Geeks is also on Twitter. And sometimes I post on that. Sometimes Dan does. I don't think Rob knows how because we haven't told him the password yet. So,
how rude.
Okay, we're gonna talk about that. Can we cut this part out right now because it's gonna get really well? No, I'll save that till later.
Okay, save it till later. Okay,
because it's gonna get really ugly.
So Paula, if we were to come to you, if the Airplane Geeks were to come to you and say, okay, we've got this, this Twitter activity, and we want it to be effective. Let's just say it's as simple as that. That's our question. How would you respond? What would you ask us? What would be your questions that you would want us to answer?
Okay. I would say, first of all, what do you mean by effective?
I guess I would say to engage our community.
Okay. So you want to develop relationships with the people that listen to the Airplane Geeks and to give them more ways to interact with you and provide you feedback?
Sure.
Okay. Great. Then what I would say is the next thing we need to do is to look at the demographics you're going after. And, you know, obviously there are people who are into aviation. Okay, we got that one.
That's the easy part. From there, it gets kind of difficult.
Right, because there's a lot of different groups that you are targeting, or at least a lot of different groups who would be interested in the Airplane Geeks. So, you know, we'd have to go into some depth. And we may want to do this on a different podcast, you know, when we've done this off the air, you know, just because there are some questions that I'd probably want to ask you about how is it funded? How are you, you know, making your... How are you getting what you need out of this, you know, so that you can support your infrastructure and everything else? Mm-hmm. And also, what kind of people do you want to expand into that you may not be reaching yet? And then, you know, from that point, we could decide, okay, where are those people now? Are there some groups on LinkedIn that you're not speaking to? Are there some groups on Twitter that you're not speaking to? And, you know, we'd expand into those areas and come up with a campaign and say, okay, you know, these are the topics that these kind of people will want to hear. These are the things that they are looking for in their lives right now. You know, either they're bored in meetings and they want something that they can listen to for an hour during their commute, or, you know, we'd have to find out a lot more about the people that listen to the Airplane Geeks. And,
well, that's an interesting issue right there. I mean, the demographics, is it difficult to understand audience demographics in new media situations compared to, you know, sort of the, you know, legacy media? I mean, we don't really have a very good grasp of who our listeners are, for example, you know, beyond some interest in aviation. I mean, we know some are pilots. We know some work for airlines, but we don't really have the kind of demographic. So is that a big issue in new media, at least with respect to aviation companies?
Well, it's easier and harder, you know, in the sense that in the old media, you had the old Nielsen ratings. And for print media, you usually had a media card that told you some things about you know, demographic information, age, income, level of education, things like that. You may not have that in all of the new media channels, but in a lot of them you have even more than that, because you can follow a user of the internet for quite, you know, in quite detail. You can see, you know, what they're mm-hmm. tweeting about over time. You can see what words they're using. You can see, you know, who they're associated with. You can see which companies they have purchased things from. You know, so there's a lot richer, I think, information in new media than there are in old. It's just not the same information that you've been looking at before. And it may not be as specific to that audience or that that media.
Okay.
And one thing I would toss in too, that I think one of the best things and one of the worst things about new media is that it allows people to interact with the source. And again, if you like interaction as the airplane geeks, it's a wonderful thing. But it also allows people to say things to you that you may not want to hear.
Right.
And that is really the issue that has slowed some companies down from getting involved in some social media, because they think, well, why would I want to encourage people to say bad things about me? But and Paul, maybe I don't know if you would agree with me on this, but in my experience, there are far fewer people saying bad things about any company than most companies probably believe. It's just that, unfortunately, the bad comments often gather more publicity than some of the mm-hmm. good ones.
Right. Well, I have to be real careful about who I work for, and, you know, for exactly that reason. And I think companies need to be a lot more scrupulous than they were in the past about how they run their businesses, because nothing is hidden anymore. You know, you mentioned, why would I want to encourage people to say bad things about me? There is no encouragement required.
It's going to come, right?
Exactly. I mean, if you're
reading
in business,
our emails too, right? I mean, you've seen the comments on Airplane Geeks. Okay.
Well, I mean, you've seen the comments on anything. I mean, people will comment on anybody they do business with. You know, whether you're listening or not is another story. And, you know, so I'm real careful about the clients that I choose for a couple of reasons. Number one, they have to have an absolutely stellar reputation. You know, everybody's going to have unhappy customers, and everybody's going to have unhappy employees because of a misunderstanding or an isolated incident or something like that. But if there's a pattern of that, I don't want to be associated with that because of that reason. It's a wide open world now. It's just like standing in the middle of Times Square having a conversation with someone. People can see who you're talking to. They can hear what you're saying. You know, if I am doing business with someone, it's transparent to anybody who cares to look. So, you know, I have to be real careful who I do business with. So, you know, the Airplane Geek should be very, very happy that you guys have such a stellar reputation that, you know, I feel comfortable being on your show. No, seriously, though. But, you know, there's a couple of things. Number one, marketing isn't going to be effective unless you're a good company now. It doesn't matter what kind of an offer you make. You know, if you're giving things away, people aren't going to want to do business with you if there's a lot of bad publicity about your company.
Right.
Sure.
But yeah, if you're a good company and you screw up occasionally, then everybody can understand that, and they can see pretty transparently how you resolved it.
Okay, Paula, we'd like to do a little thing that we call word association, which you may be familiar with. This is simply where we mention a word or a phrase and you just start talking about whatever comes into your head. So are you game?
Great. Sure, why not?
Okay, I'll ask Rob if he's able to kick it off.
Absolutely. And I think I would ask Google Analytics.
Google Analytics. Lies. No, actually,
lies.
It's great. But the reason I tell you that is because people get so hung up on their traffic numbers. And who cares how much traffic you're getting? What matters is how many sales you're making.
Yeah, good point.
Yeah. So, you know, people get all hung up. Well, we got to get to 400, you know, today or whatever. It doesn't matter. What matters is that you've made, you know, 50 sales today. And, you know, if you're getting a ton of traffic and they're just loafing around and, you know, not interacting, not leaving messages, not leaving comments, not meeting your objective, then, you know, I think Google Analytics is one of the biggest distractors from marketing objectives that I've ever seen. How's that?
Yeah. It's like measuring how many people walk in the door of the store and not what are they walking out with after making a purchase.
Exactly. Or are they walking out happy? And are they smiling?
So how do you think the maybe this is too broad a question, but how do you think the aviation industry is doing in that regard? Do we get it?
Well, one of the things that I've noticed about the aviation people that I know really well, my husband included, he's a math guy, and they love things that they can measure, which is a very good thing. And that's, I think, part of the reason that Google Analytics is so incredibly popular. But I think, you know, your objective needs to be thought out other than in, you know, what's necessarily easy to measure. So, you know, okay, so you have X amount of traffic. That's great. And you can see it on a neat little chart. But sales, you usually have to keep in an Excel spreadsheet, and it's a little harder to track, mm-hmm. you know, when those happened. Were they in the morning? Were they in the afternoon? Were they, you know, during the drive time? Were they right after you did this blog post? You know, those kinds of things are harder to measure, but more important to keep track of, I think.
I sometimes think that analytics were developed by consultants because companies would often say, well, how do we know that what you're doing is working? And they said, you know, we don't.
Yeah.
We better figure something out.
You know, the biggest scam, I think, in social media is these people that say, I'll get you to number one on Google.
Oh, yeah.
I'll get you to a number one position for this particular keyword on Google. And number one, how do you know that that keyword is what people are looking for your product or service with? That's number one. Number two is, how does that translate into meeting your objective? You know, and in a lot of cases, it lasts for all of 2 weeks while this company has a bunch of people from other countries clicking on your website, and then it goes away, and people wonder why they spent all this money and didn't make any sales. So, you know, it really, anyway, I'm probably getting completely off topic, but that I think is one of the biggest scams.
I think you're right on. I mean, because that is one of the issues that we see with marketing topics all the time is that companies think that the goal is to design a really great ad or a wonderful website or put mm-hmm. together a perfect social media program. And we say things to them like, well, no, but what is it that you want to happen? What is it mm-hmm. that people are supposed to do when they sign out of your Twitter and they go, I don't know. And you go, well, see, but you need to know that. And they go, well, mm-hmm. no, I just really want to build a website. So,
you know, I've got a blog post that I'm working on that even before it's published, and that's it's an analogy between a really, really, really beautiful smoking website, and you know, you compare that to an airplane that has a $1 million paint job but no engine. You know, it looks absolutely fabulous sitting in the hangar. You can take people by it and people go, ooh, ah, that's really, really cool. That's really neat or whatever. But it doesn't do what an airplane's supposed to do. You know, and this website that you've just spent a ridiculous amount of money on is just sitting there looking really cool and not being seen by anyone or not accomplishing anything. And I think that's one of the big tragedies of marketing that makes me crazy.
Well, Paula, that kind of leads into my word that I had for you, which is
okay.
Branding.
Branding. Cattle.
That's exactly what I was thinking when you said that. Oh, that's great. Okay.
No, that's not a good good term.
I like her. We better have her on again.
I think so. if she can stand us.
Oh, I think you guys are fabulous. But no, branding, I think, is a very good thing. And again, it's another tool to reach your objective, to make yourself recognizable to your target audience and to make sure that they recognize you in whatever guise they see you. You know, you may show up in Twitter, you may show up in Facebook, you may show up as a blog post on a news feed. Those kinds of things don't have the typical logos and other kinds of marks, symbols, mm-hmm. things like that people have typically used for branding. But there are ways to, you know, change your Twitter background. There are ways to make sure that your message always has a certain tone, or that your email signature always has a similar message. You know, there's ways of doing branding in social media that are just as important to say are in traditional marketing. So I think it's a great tool.
Can you think of any aviation companies that do a particularly good job of branding?
Well, Southwest, of course, comes to mind.
Okay, sure.
you know, they do a great blog. They've got lots and lots of pictures. Their message is, of course, nuts about Southwest. You know, it's people mm-hmm. above numbers. It's, you know, they do a really good job of presenting a great image. And, of course, any of my clients, Summit Aviation, does a great job. Proudly AMA does a great job. Pilot Geeks do a great job. And ABCI does a great job, I think. But that's me.
Okay. Well, that's great. Anything else you'd like to add that we haven't covered already?
I think that is it. You guys are a lot of fun. This is a lot more fun than I was expecting it to be.
That's what I've
not done a podcast before.
That's a good thing. Actually, I do have one thing I would love to mention, if it's possible, Max.
Rob, go ahead.
At the National Business Aviation Show coming up in Orlando in a couple of weeks, there's going to be a social media for business aviation segment on Wednesday, October the 21st from 3 to 5. And we're going to be talking about social media. And wait, let me see who's running that. I'm moderating that. Oh, my God.
Imagine that.
You are. Cool.
I just noticed it. No, we're going to have some fun. We're going to have some good folks. Pat Dunn from NBA will be there, and Mike Nichols. And we're having Benet Wilson from the Business Aviation blog, and Ryan Keough, who's the manager of marketing and communications at Qatar, the Qatar FBO network. And we're going to have a lot of fun. So people that are going to be at NBAA, and if you're on Twitter, I mean, you'll find out about it. But I just thought I'd mention it because it's going to be a lot of fun.
Sounds great. Sounds great. And you know, speaking of going back to branding a little bit, I did want to mention something that kind of relates to that, which was that, you know, I have my website is 30,000 feet, and I had noticed another blog that was created by a guy named Quinn in the UK, actually, with the same name.
Uh-oh.
And I sent him an email and I said, you know, I've had that name. I've used that name for many, many years. And, you know, I see that you're using the same name, and I think that might cause some confusion because we're really kind of after the same, you know, the same audience. And he wrote back and he's went ahead and he actually changed the name. It's now 37,000 feet, which is kind of a decent thing to do. I was really encouraged that you know that he would do that. But this is it's a UK-based airline blog, so people might want to take a look at it. He actually created it for a university assignment, and he's I think he should get an A because it's a pretty good airline blog. So I'll give him the plug for having the decency to, you know, do the right thing, I guess, and change the name. So it's this is all words written out, 30-7-1000-feet.blogspot.com. So I'll give him a little plug.
That's nice.
That's a lot nicer than most people would be. I think, do you know, in fact, my somebody started following my wife on Twitter, and he said his ID is the nicest guy in town, which, of course, I immediately thought was dangerous, but it's just, but maybe it's Max. Maybe Max is the nicest guy in town.
No, my wife wouldn't agree with that.
But he does seem to inspire that in people.
Yeah.
All right. Paula, thanks again for joining us.
Thank you. It's been a lot of fun.
The didgeridoo means it's time for the Australia News Desk. Here's two of the craziest guys we could find south of the equator. It's Steve Vischer and Grant McHaren from the Plane Crazy Down Under podcast.
Hooray! Oh, thank you. Thank you. It's so good to be here. Hang on, Steve.
Yeah, what? I can't hear about all this celebrating.
Mate. Tell the screaming masses to be quiet just for a sec. I mean, what's going on?
It's a big week, mate. It's a big week this week. Are you sitting down?
Oh, I'm totally sitting down.
Australia's population this week got topped 22 million.
22 million. Woohoo! Oh, wow. We finally have more than the daytime working population of Manhattan on our entire island that happens to be almost the size of the continental United States. Go us.
I thought it was looking a little bit crowded over here lately, so there you go.
Yeah. Oh, hey, does that 22 million include wombats, koalas, echidnas, and so on, and kangaroos, or is it just the people?
Well, who would know with our Department of Statistics over here?
True that. Yes, indeed.
So there you go, folks. That's something to celebrate here, I suppose. It's a huge population for a country that's about the same size as yours physically. But
yeah, well, I'm having a beer just to celebrate. Yay!
Yeah, anyway, moving on. Take a drink. Back thanks, Dave. Anyway, on a serious note this week, it's been quite a tragic week over here in many ways in this region of the world. We've had, obviously, tsunamis and earthquakes. We woke very early last week to hear news such as this.
Devastation and heartbreak as Samoans count the cost of a deadly tsunami. More than 140 people killed, among them three Australians. Many more injured as the world scrambles to provide aid.
And that was on Samoa. That earthquake also went right around that region, affecting places such as Tonga, and on the other side of that plate, it also caused an earthquake in Sumatra and in Indonesia.
That's correct. It was two earthquakes in Sumatra very soon thereafter. The Tongan one was over 8 on the Richter scale, which is pretty huge. That's even bigger than the one that moved New Zealand closer to Australia by 20 centimetres. As many people may know, the whole Pacific Rim, New Zealand, Australia, up around through Indonesia and around through Japan, across to Alaska and back down through California and out and around again is known as the Ring of Fire, the Pacific area, plate area. And for the last year or so, we've been watching a lot of earthquakes and a lot of activity. We've even had earthquakes close here to Melbourne, which typically never happens. And we're pretty interested watching it. So now a couple of these really huge earthquakes going on, and it's interesting. We're waiting to see if the other shoe drops now.
Yeah, and where this fits in with the local aviation scene down here, of course, is the Air Force here has been mobilised. Here and in New Zealand. In fact, even civilian flights Air New Zealand's been operating its 777s across to the affected regions to ferry their nationals out. And the Royal Australian Air Force has been extremely busy sending Hercules and C-17s across the Pacific and, of course, up north to assist in the relief efforts there. There's been many, many news reports this week of Australian Defence Force personnel on the ground in Sumatra.
And in the air and even on the ocean, the Royal Australian Navy's been sending one of their amphibious landing vessels there with its helicopter contingent and so on. The interesting part is Air New Zealand put on an additional 767 flight, and it sold out within 24 hours, and they've now upgraded to a 777.
So yeah, a lot of tragic news there, mate, to cover. And although it's not strictly an aviation story, it does lead us on to an article that we found in The Australian this week, not by Steve Creedy, just for something different.
Oh, there's a change.
And that's talking about a proposal for a trans-Tasman partnership between Australia and New Zealand, moving their militaries much closer together to provide a better equipped rapid reaction force to respond to regional contingencies in the South Pacific region.
That's correct. We're having a lot more issues down here in the South Pacific. The water levels are increasing slightly. The low-pressure storm systems are getting stronger. The coral is dying, and islands are getting wiped out. And between earthquakes, tidal waves, and just general storm surges, there's a lot of trouble occurring in the South Pacific. So having a rapid reaction force is a good idea, especially as the New Zealand Air Force now is pretty much limited to P3 Orions and the Hercules. They do have other aircraft, but they're the big ones. They downgraded their military jets and so on, as we've reported previously, and the Kiwis don't really have any plans to invest into like C-17s or C-130Js or go for the P-8A surveillance aircraft and things like that. So it's getting interesting. New Zealand leads the way in a lot of areas, but definitely not in terms of its punch in the military side of things. So getting New Zealand and Australia working together, there's a lot of ways they can help each other to assist other nations.
Yeah, it'll be interesting to see how they proceed with this. The Defence Minister from Australia and in fact New Zealand's defence minister have been discussing this recently. You're talking about the New Zealand Air Force's fleet. At the moment, according to this article, the fixed wing fleet of the Royal New Zealand Air Force now consists of just 5 C-130Hs and 6 P-3K Orion surveillance aircraft. Pretty small. Of course, their C-130s, even if they are old, are still very, very capable aircraft. The only thing is, of course, there's just not that many of them, and although the Australian Air Force is not that huge by global standards, it's certainly far more sizable than that.
It's a little bit better tooled up than the Kiwis are at the moment. Mind you, those P-3K Orions are pretty impressive. They were leading the way for a while with the software and technology they had on board their Orions in terms of general operation. They're not quite as cool as the Aurora aircraft and the surveillance aircraft that operate in North America and Canada and so on.
However, we should move on to some other new aircraft. And I know you guys were speaking last week about delays in the much maligned US military tanker program. And I was talking to you also last week about how the Royal Australian Air Force is getting some KC-30s of its own. We find a report this week in Australian Aviation that says that program has also now been delayed.
Yeah, that's right. Australian Aviation, one of our favourite magazines, if not our favourite aviation magazine down here in Australia, has confirmed that the KC-30A, which is an A330 multi-role tanker transport aircraft, will not now be delivered into service until mid-2010, an overall delay of nearly 18 months. The first aircraft was produced in Europe. The second aircraft is undergoing modifications here in Australia by Qantas Defence Services, but it's actually going to go back to Europe to help out with the certification of the type because they're running a little slow on it.
Yeah, the interesting thing here is they're talking about one bit of technology, which is the fly-by-wire boom.
Yeah, that's right. It's always a tricky thing is to have the boom working correctly, as the Japanese have discovered with the KC-767s. They've had some flutter and some problems in the flying boom for refueling. The indications are that the KC-30 is doing reasonably well, but it hasn't actually done a wet transfer. It's only ever done dry transfers where they connect and hold formation, but no fuel goes between the aircraft.
Yeah, well, let's hope they get that sorted out really quickly because, as I said last week, the Royal Australian Air Force currently has no tanking capacity. They're having to rely on other nations and private commercial operators such as Omega Tanker to support their refueling efforts at the moment. So it's saying here that the RAF won't take delivery until late next year, and with the delivery program continuing on until 2012. So let's hope they get that thing certified and up and running quickly.
Yeah, well, that's why Australia sent F-111s to the recent Red Flag out of Nellis, I believe it is. They stage out of Nellis Air Force Base for the Red Flag competitions in the US. They were expecting to send F-18s, but they didn't have any tankers to take them across and weren't in a position to be able to hire them. So they sent the F-111s because they've got long legs and can pretty much style and hop their way across to the US.
Long legs, hey? Let's use that as a segue, mate, for our last article. Speaking of, well, creatures with long legs, might be some very unhappy cows over here. Qantas has been criticised over using foreign butter on its aircraft.
Yeah, here in Australia, we've got farmers in Tasmania collapsing as the excessive rain and recent power cuts are cutting into them. And, of course, the global downturn and demand for dairy products is also hitting Australian farmers as well. And according to an article here in the ABC News, it's been discovered that Qantas is importing butter for its Australian flights. And Qantas, the great Australian airline, which makes a big thing about using Australian where possible, has turned around and imported butter from Denmark. And that's, to say the least, raised the ire, shall we say, of farmers around Australia, and especially those in Tasmania. They're going under and they're finding it hard to sell their product, and Qantas is saying, well, it's actually cheaper to bring it in from Denmark.
Hey, maybe they're using the link there. Don't we have an Australian who's married to their royal family over there in Denmark? Maybe that's what the link is.
It could be.
It's
could
a technicality, be. Mate. It's just a technicality.
Well, Qantas are quick to turn out that they imported cheaper Danish butter because of the downturn in the aviation industry so as to minimise job losses. In other words, trying to say that if they had have used the slightly more expensive Australian butter, they would have had to have laid some people off, so this was a better deal. They're also pointing out very quickly that the butter served in their lounges around Australia is Australian.
Uh-huh. So there's a tip for anybody who's wanting to use local Australian-made butter if you're flying on a Qantas flight. Just steal some from the lounge before you get on the plane.
There you go, if you can manage to get your way through the crowd of people trying to get their free food.
Yes, and if anybody pulls you up for stealing stuff, Grant McHaren's phone number is... No, we won't go on that.
Whoa. That's only written on certain walls, but we won't go into that.
We won't go into that. Well, folks, I think that's about all we've got to report for you this week. Oh, one more thing we ought to mention before we go is that, of course, as we're recording this tonight on Sunday night Australian time, we're waiting for our good friend of our podcast, Matt Hall. Who's currently qualified third for tonight's race in Barcelona.
Go, Matt. Go, Matt.
Yes, close personal friend of the Plane Crazy Down Under podcast. So let's everybody support him. I know you're in America over there, but, you know, it's very important that you support us poor Australians down here and our Top Gun champions.
And we'll introduce you to a new Australian phrase. Go, you good thing.
Go, you good thing.
Yeah.
All right, folks, that's enough of that silliness. Until next week, I'm Steve Vischer.
And I'm Grant McHaren.
Cheers, guys.
Ciao, y'all.
Paula Williams, again, thank you for being our guest on this episode.
Thank you for having me.
And can you tell our listeners where they can find you and the activities you're involved in?
Absolutely. You can find me at Paula_ABCI on Twitter. You can find me at a very long URL, www.aviationbusinessconsultants.com, or you can find me on Facebook as Paula Williams or Aviation Business Consultants.
That's great. And Dan, how can people find you online?
If for any reason people would like to read my random crap about the airlines, you can find that.
As my wife would say, the guy has issues.
Serious.
You can find my blog at thingsinthesky.com, and you can find me on Twitter at Dan Webbage.
Great, and I'm Max Flight. You can find me at 30,000feet.com as Max Flight on Twitter. You can also follow us, the Airplane Geeks, on Twitter or visit airplanegeeks.com, leave a comment, sign up for our newsletter, which comes out sporadically as Dan finds time.
I'm sorry.
Or you can order an Airplane Geeks t-shirt. You can send us email at thegeeks@airplanegeeks.com. You can subscribe to us on iTunes, and we're also in the Zoom Marketplace. And perhaps the best way you can help spread the word about the Airplane Geeks podcast is, guys,
tell Steve this should give Rob his money.
Well, you know, can I just interrupt? I mean, you gave Dan an opportunity to talk about where people can find him, and certainly ask Paula, which is certainly a wonderful thing to do for our guests. But Max, you forgot to ask me.
Rob, where can people find you online? I did forget, didn't I? Oh, so
yeah,
I'm sorry.
It's okay. So you know that thing you always tell us about when you start every show about, oh, I've got my friends and my comrades and my associates, Dan and Rob here. Dan, I think I'm starting to line up with you there, buddy. I don't think he really cares about us.
Oh, the cat's out of the bag.
Yeah.
No, not true.
Yeah, the cat's out of the bag. You can find me at jetwine.com or at... on Twitter, it's just plain Jetwine.
Fantastic.
But before we sign off here, Rob, I noticed you've been tweeting throughout this recording session, and one of them I could get, but quote, just saw Surrogates with Bruce Willis, definitely worth it despite the questionable reviews. I'm trying to wonder how that relates to what we're doing right now.
Well, it actually has nothing to do with what we're doing right now, but of course, Dan, You didn't need to read it and react to it, but I'm sorry, my brain is going in 9 different directions at once. It was multitasking. Multitasking was popular. So,
okay. Okay.
I just thought I'd mention that. So just chill out, baby, and go see the movie. It's good. So.
All right. Before this goes on forever, join us again next week as we talk aviation on the Airplane Geeks podcast. Bye, everybody.
Bye, everybody. See ya. Thanks for listening. Hot as hell.